P&G is out with better than expected earnings this morning, but did warn the inflationary environment remains very challenging. I caught up with P&G Vice Chairman John Mohler to chat about the company's outlook. Worth noting here, Mohler will take over as P&G's CEO on November 1st, succeeding David Taylor. Earnings out, better than expected here. Sales up in each of your divisions. What's your read on the consumer right now?
Strong. We just had our 13th consecutive quarter of volume, sales, consumption, and market share growth. Market growth rates across the world are reasonably strong, and certainly so in the U.S.
Are you seeing any resistance by the U.S. shopper to some of the price increases P&G has put through?
You know, our business model, which is innovation-based, seeks to build value for consumers through a combination of performance and value. And as a result of that, pricing is a normal part of our business rhythm. Pricing has been a positive contributor to our top line for 44 of the last 47 quarters, for 16 out of the last 17 years. Having said that, the price increases that we've put into the market just recently have only been reflected on shelf for about a month, so it's a little bit early to tell. But I feel good based on the strength of the consumer, the strength of our offerings and their superiority within their categories. We have products available at different price points for consumers with different needs, and a very, very strong innovation program supporting all of that.
You've been at P&G, John, since 1988. You've seen a lot of cycles. I'm not calling you old here. I'm just saying, 1988 seems like a long time ago. Is this the worst inflationary backdrop you have ever seen?
If we just look at two components of cost, commodities and transportation, our current forecast is that will be a $2.2 billion after-tax increase versus a year ago. We saw about $600 million after-tax increase in those costs in the quarter that we just completed. So it is a significant inflationary cycle. As opposed to prior cycles, we're in a better place from a product superiority standpoint. We're in a much better place from a cost productivity standpoint. We've built those muscles over the last decade, and those should stand us in good stead as we work our way through the current situation. We see this as a rough patch from a bottom line standpoint for a period of time, but a patch that we should continue to grow through and invest walking forward to opportunities, not stepping back.
You did lift your inflationary outlook. As you mentioned, $2.2 billion. You were at $1.9 billion, if I'm correct. Where is inflation surprising you?
It's pretty broad across the input spectrum. If you, again, just look at different commodities, whether it's commodities that are derived from the petro complex, pulp, liner board, et cetera, whether it's gasoline to fuel transportation vehicles. If you look at commodities, generally, they're up anywhere between 50 and 150% versus a year ago. And I can paint that story with a pretty broad brush.
There were some, I believe, some recent price increases P&G took in the baby care business this month. Are you looking at any more price increases, just, you know, given how quickly inflation is coming on here?
So we've previously announced price increases in baby care, feminine protection, adult incontinence, home care, and fabric care. We recently just released to the trade news of price increases in our grooming business and parts of our personal care business and in our oral care business. So 9 out of 10 categories in the U.S. have some form of price increase across part of the lineup.
China is a big market for P&G, of course, John. Big there with Head and Shoulders. Have you seen any slowdown in growth in that China market? GDP does appear to be tailing off here.
If we look at consumption within our categories, it continues to grow up 6 to 7% per year. If you look at our results, they're in line with that, up 12% on a two-year stacked basis. Our business in the last quarter was flat versus a year ago, but that has more to do with the timing of big events like Double 11 and the inventory build into that than anything else. Fundamental consumption remains pretty strong and is one of our higher growth markets.
I was joking around with you a little bit, John, before we came on. I remember taping videos with you when I was essentially in a closet, working out of a closet in another place, and you were the CFO of the company. You've touched every position, key leadership position of this company. You could become P&G CEO on November 1st. What is your biggest priority when you do take over officially?
Biggest priority is sustaining excellence. Again, I mentioned this is the 13th consecutive quarter of volume, sales, consumption, and market share growth. As part of that, supporting the team. Successful multinational business is not an individual sport. It's a team sport. We have a fantastic team. They've done tremendous work through the pandemic, and I expect them to carry us through to the next chapter.
Before I let you go, how important is ESG to you when you do take the helm of CEO? I found it very interesting that P&G is now going to be tying executive compensation to the progress it does make on ESG. I wish a lot of other executives were doing that out there. You know, how much of a focus is that inside the company?
It's been a focus for a decade or more. All aspects, whether that's governance, our employee representation, and obviously environmental sustainability. It's something our consumers care about. It's something our customers, our retail partners care about. It's something our employees care very much about and something we're committed to deliver on.
The first U.S. Bitcoin futures exchange traded fund debut today over in the New York Stock Exchange, as Inez just mentioned. What will it mean for the future of cryptocurrencies, though? Eric Balchunas is a senior ETF analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence and joins us now. Eric, good morning to you. Is this a good development more so for traders or investors?
Traders in this case. So, you know, this is a Bitcoin futures ETF. And typically, the way I'd put it is this way. This ETF is more like the USO of Bitcoin, that oil fund that tracks futures, rather than the GLD of Bitcoin. That's going to come later, hopefully. But for now, the SEC was only comfortable approving ETFs to track futures. And the problem with futures is they expire. And so you have to constantly go to the next month to keep exposure. And when you do that, you usually have to incur a little cost because the next month is usually a little more expensive. Do that for 12 months, you're going to end up with what's called roll costs. And that will be how much you miss the price of Bitcoin by. That said, in the near term, this will track very well. The daily correlation to the spot Bitcoin of BITO is going to be almost perfect. And it's going to be really good weekly and even monthly. But over the course of a year, 2 years, 3 years, it will probably miss the price of Bitcoin by 5 to 10%. So if you looked at that as a cost, you'd be like, wow, it's pretty expensive. That's why advisors probably won't buy it. But that liquidity it's going to get and that daily sensitivity to spot Bitcoin and the options market, people are going to start buying calls and puts on this thing. It's going to get exciting. And I think that excitement really will be driven by the traders, not long-term investors.
Hey, Eric, it's Julie here. It's good to be reunited with you. For those of you who don't know, Eric Balchunas probably knows more about ETFs than anyone I know, and literally wrote a book about them, which if you're super into ETFs, you should check out. So, Eric, there's been this feeling that the whole crypto industry was just waiting for one of these ETFs to come to market, and then this would unlock yet another phase of adoption, which has been one of their big buzzwords. It sounds like from what you're saying, that's not necessarily the case, perhaps, until we get a spot ETF.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I think, you know, crypto, the crypto crowd loves to get excited about anything. You know, they're, as you know, they just want to see the price go up. So they really rallied around this. And our team was very bullish on the approval. And so they definitely love what we were saying, even though we just wanted to be right. We weren't trying to please them, but they certainly were. I could tell the excitement was there. That said, look, these ETFs that track futures, you know, maybe they get 4 or 5, maybe even 10 billion over a year, but that would be only 1% of ETF flows. And that would only be less than 1% of the whole Bitcoin market. So you got to put that into context. What I tell them is that this ETF isn't the big deal. The big deal is that it represents the first step down a long road that will ultimately lead to this. You'll have a Bitcoin ETF that's physically backed, an Ether ETF, a crypto basket. Cathie Wood will start doing crypto picking ETFs, and most of it will be very liquid and very cheap. There could even be a Vanguard total crypto market index fund for like 5 basis points in 5 years That's the dream. That will bring the advisor money. That's where $30 trillion lies. And that's ultimately what's going to happen. ETFs have done this to every asset class. That's what they do. So it just takes, you know, 5 to 10 years to pull it off.
Hey, Eric, it's Brian Chung here. I mean, this is just kind of the jackpot, if you will. ETFs have been high. You see mutual funds converting to ETFs. You see all these ESG ETFs. And then you have Bitcoin, and we already know the buzz around that. But what's been interesting to me has been in response to BITO, the scrambling that's been going on among those that have filed or were thinking about filing ETFs to whether or not they wanted to do Bitcoin futures or do Bitcoin spot, right? We know Grayscale is really kind of in the latter, but what was interesting was that Invesco actually dropped out of their filing for a Bitcoin futures ETF. So it's almost like Squid Game. Everyone's trying to figure out what team they want to be on here. What are you seeing in that space in just the last 24 to 48 hours in terms of whether or not it's the Bitcoin spot or the Bitcoin futures now that's more lucrative?
Yeah, our analyst Rebecca in Hong Kong compared to Squid Game. It really is. Or it almost reminds me of a campaign. Oh my God, you know, Kamala Harris dropped out. This one's getting this. This got endorsed by this. It's very much feels like, I kind of feel like Nate Silver, to be honest, a little bit in terms of us trying to predict things and people looking to us. But I agree with you. There's going to be a lot of real intensity over the next couple of days. And I'll tell you why. Because if you're going to be the ETF that ever the traders like, you got to have volume. And if you're going to have volume, you kind of got to get the market quickly. It's hard to steal volume. It's easier to steal assets. So that's why you're going to find Valkyrie and VanEck and some of the other ones are going to fight as best they can to get out quickly. Grayscale tried to tell everybody today and steal the thunder from the launch of the pro shares by saying they're going to actually convert their ETF, even though that'll take a while. You can see people are just trying to step over each other, steal the thunder, get the spotlight, get out quickly. Ultimately, because the first couple of days, the clay will start to harden. You know, it's only like soft for like a week, 2 weeks, maybe a month. And then it kind of sticks, right? GLD is still the most traded gold ETF and with the most assets. SPY is still the most traded ETF with the most assets. So everybody in the ETF world knows first to market is crucial. And that's why you see this sort of Squid Game activity.
So Eric, your team, part of what you guys do is you try to game out who's going to be the first, right? If you're the Nate Silver of ETFs, then and you listed a bunch that are out there, give us sort of your breakdown of who you think is most likely to be next market.
Yeah, so we think ProShares will probably take ProShares having just 1 day lead is crucial. Valkyrie just said that the exchange updated their effective date till tomorrow, but they still haven't filed this one thing you need. So it's possible Valkyrie's out tomorrow. Who knows? But even a 1 day lead will help ProShares. I've already looked at the volume. The ProShares Bitcoin ETF has already traded close to $400 million in the first 40 minutes. That already puts it in the top 10 biggest launches of all time. It could break the record, which you know would make it have to get to $1 billion. But it's only, what, 10 a.m. and it's got 400 million. It's looking good. That's how much, and that volume is going to be so hard to take away for anyone coming after. But I do see Valkyrie out next. I see VanEck maybe in 2 weeks. And then after that, Bitwise, and then ARK will probably be in December sometime. And you will have people like Cathie Wood come in ARK. And okay, she missed all the volume. You know, maybe two ETFs have all the volume, but she has an audience. And so some of these ones that come later will try to exploit some of their built-in audiences. And they'll do okay. They'll probably have enough assets to live, but there really can only be one liquidity king, maybe two. And so my money would be on ProShares to Bina just simply because they got out first.
And let's talk GBTC also, speaking of having already an audience, right? Because it already exists as a trust. People already invested in it. Now that the futures are out, we talked to Michael Sonnenschein, head of Grayscale, yesterday. He said they're in consistent discussions with the SEC about this. He said futures open the door. So how quickly do you think that could come out, if at all? And do you think we're finally going to see the gap between it and Bitcoin start to narrow if it ETFizes?
Sure. It's trading at a 20% discount. So there's people who are starting to get attracted to that because if you buy that and they convert, you instantly make 20%. The question is, when could it convert? I am bearish on this because here's why. Gary Gensler, the head of the SEC, just isn't really comfortable with the 1933 Act. And that's what GBTC would have to convert under. That's what the physically backed ones would have to be approved under because Bitcoin isn't security. It can't go under the 40 Act, which Gensler likes. Only futures can. So the question that Grayscale should be asked anytime they're on is, when will Gary Gensler be comfortable with the 1933 Act, which has much less investor protections than the 40 Act? If and when that happens, then GBTC will convert, probably when the other physically ones get approved. If you force me to pick a date, I would go with probably a year to 18 months for that, but I just don't know.
Wow.
Well, I just wrote that question down, Erica. We will put it to him. Eric Balchun is senior ETF analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Really awesome insights here.
Well, the Milken Conference is going on in Southern California. A number of different folks gathering there to talk economics, markets, policy, for that matter. One of those folks is Scott Minard over at Guggenheim. He, of course, is the chief investment officer there. Scott, it's always great to talk to you. And what's interesting is, as I looked at some of your recent commentary, your recent notes, I'm seeing a theme that is echoed perhaps elsewhere in the markets, which is you have a lot of concerns about challenges out there, but at the same time, you think stocks can continue to push higher. So explain to me what maybe on the face of it looked like a disconnect.
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting, and I appreciate you having me, Julie. Is, you know, there's an old saying that bull markets climb a wall of worry. And if that's the case in this situation, we have a big wall ahead of us, which means we could still have a big bull market. But, you know, the reason that I'm so positive is there are two things right now. One is there's still a lot of excess liquidity sloshing around the system. Though the central banks are starting to move toward taper, there's still more money to come. And then the second thing is the seasonal factors. Just around the time of the World Series, which the Dodgers will win this year, the market tends to rally. And so, you know, I did write a commentary a few months back about I was concerned about a pullback that might be related to the economic slowdown from a resurgence in COVID, which I think we did get. You know, clearly, I think in the last week, the markets have bottomed out, and we're going to see stocks perform very well for the rest of the year and probably into the first half of next year.
Scott, I will not weigh in on the Dodgers. I'm not qualified nor equipped to talk about anything sports related. Maybe the guys can drop into that role. So it sounds like also, as you're talking about this liquidity question, there seems to be a lot of comfort on the part of the market with the tapering and even with potentially rates going up at some point next year or beyond. Do you think it's going to be a rockier process, even though it's well telegraphed, when it actually starts to happen?
Well, I think that tapering is pretty much accepted. And if you look at what we went through back in 2018 during the taper up until the fourth quarter, you know, the market continued to rally and perform well. So I don't think taper in and of itself is going to be the catalyst that would be a sell-off. But I do think that we have a slow-moving train coming out of China. The Evergrande situation in and of itself will be contained. I think that the Chinese have that well under control. But the problem is that 20 to 30% of economic output in China is related to property development. And there's a massive overbuilding which has occurred. And, you know, like our housing crisis, they need to work through that inventory. And so while I'm not expecting a crash in prices in China, because the market is so controlled and contained, I do think it's going to lead to a substantial economic slowdown. And the impact on that to the region and to the rest of the world at this stage of the game is largely untested and could be like the Asian crisis. Back in 1997, when the Thai baht was devalued, it really didn't hit our shores until the fourth quarter of 1998, when long-term capital collapsed. So I think you know, this is very similar, and it could be a significant problem for the markets in the second half of next year. But I don't think people are very focused on that time frame right now.
Hey, Scott, it's Brian Chung here. I wanted to ask about whether or not you see leverage being an issue in the United States as well, because we know that the stimulus has enabled a lot of kind of junk credit to thrive in this environment. I mean, what was interesting, I think there hasn't been a single default for a triple C rated issuer in the last 3 months. And the last time we had a streak like that was in 2007. So is leverage stateside also an issue to the degree that maybe you were just describing, at least in China?
Well, it certainly is an issue, Brian, but I think something interesting has occurred in our country in the last year or so, and that is that the Federal Reserve essentially has socialized credit risk. And so if interest rates start to rise and that puts pressure on credit markets, there's a high degree of confidence right now that the Fed is going to step in and stabilize things. That may not happen. They may be tested on this. But I do think that if they do get tested, that there is a reaction function at the Fed where they will take a more active role to contain credit contagion. So I'm not overly concerned about credit right now. And as far as interest rates are concerned, the other big impact of all this debt is it really constrains the Federal Reserve and its ability to raise short-term rates. And our work shows that you really can't push short-term rates much above 2% before it starts impinging upon corporate cash flows, and that is would be negative for credit. So that would pretty much tell us that the top of the cycle will be for tightening will be around 2%, which would also mean that the 10-year note would probably be around 2% at the end of the cycle, because historically the 10-year note is always trading around the same level as overnight rates when the Fed completes its tightening cycle.
Well, from a macro picture, if I could follow up on that, what is the consequence? I mean, if it's okay that these triple C-rated issuers, for example, can keep hobbling along, what will the consequences be if the Fed has to tighten maybe at an even faster timeline than what you just outlined? Because if anything, that seems to be the prevailing tail risk here, that if inflationary pressures run amok, then the Fed's going to have to tighten faster and earlier. Could that pop a bubble? Could that kill some zombie companies and really create a mess?
Well, I don't think so, again, because I think they're going to be very constrained. Obviously, we're going to lose some companies as the Fed starts to raise rates. The question is will it become systemic? And that's the point where the Federal Reserve is going to have to intervene. The policies that we've established in the era after the great financial crisis really have tied the Fed's hands. And so, the Fed is basically responsible for the market now, a role that it wasn't designed to do when it was created in 1914. And the evolution of central bank policy has been to keep expanding its role in supporting the economy. And one of the things it'll have to do to support the economy is let inflation go if it has to in order to stabilize the credit situation and risk assets.
And Scott, if the Fed has in fact socialized policy, as you mentioned here, what is the risk to global markets, bond markets, stock markets, you name it, if the Biden administration doesn't reappoint Jay Powell as Fed chair?
I don't think it's going to matter very much. I think Chairman Powell, will lean toward the dovish side anyway. Clearly Secretary Yellen would like to see him reappointed. I doubt that's likely now in the wake of what's happened and the issues with Elizabeth Warren. That probably means Lyle Brainard will be front and center. And, Lyle Brainard is a dove, and the president is going to get to do 4 appointments within the next year at the Federal Reserve, and he has a great opportunity to appoint people. And I think given the pressures from the populist side of the party, that he's going to have to basically appoint people who are in favor of easy money.
And so then what is that going to mean for policy, Scott?
Well, I mean,
continued easy money, I guess.
The dirty little secret is, we are already doing MMT. We don't call it MMT. But yeah, you know, let's face it, the government, the central bank is financing the government as the stimulus pulls back, which it is right now. The likelihood of a stimulus package today looks to be in the neighborhood of $1.5 trillion on top of the infrastructure package. That's going to take a lot of pressure off the Treasury market for supply, new supply, and so the Fed will be able to pull back without having interest rates spike. But the minute we're in trouble again, the Fed has basically appointed itself as the guardian of the economy, and it's going to intervene to do whatever it has to do.
Well, we'll be looking for those personnel changes and other changes potentially over the next year or so. Scott, thanks so much. It's always great to catch up with you. Be well. Scott Minard is Guggenheim Chief Investment Officer.
Well, we've seen Bitcoin pushing above that $60,000 level in the run-up to the launch of this ETF. Our next guest says this could trigger a Bitcoin rally, with the digital currency soaring to $168,000 by year end. Let's bring in Sean Farrell, Fundstrat Head of Digital Asset Strategy. Sean, you certainly got my attention when I saw $168,000. Walk me through your thesis.
Hey, Akiko. First off, thanks for having me. So I'm sure a lot of people saw our head of research, Tom Lee's note yesterday, citing the potential for over upwards of $50 billion of inflows in the first year of, BTO's trading history. And, you know, I think the whole premise is based on the fact that a lot of people are discounting the unmet demand right now for exposure to Bitcoin in traditional financial markets. I don't recall where I saw this number, but I think somewhere around $24 trillion of assets being managed by professional financial advisors and financial planners don't have, frictionless access to Bitcoin at the moment. And if we step back and just surmise that perhaps a few bips of that $24 trillion of capital, is allocated to a Bitcoin, albeit futures-based ETF, we're looking at hitting that $50 billion figure pretty easily.
I mean, so far, the day one trading volume, I think, has impressed a lot of people from what we were just talking about there in this ETF, given the fact that, it wasn't the same as owning spot Bitcoin outright. It's, you got to deal with some issues here, but it's baby steps. And I suppose, Bitcoin's prices always move a little maybe more volatile than what the news suggests. We saw that on the downside here when we were talking about China cracking down on mining. So maybe not completely unexpected to see a big pop today. It's granted not a huge pop, but Bitcoin moving up today off of the launch of the ETF. I mean, how soon is too soon to call this being as big as people are talking about? It's one day of inflows, but I mean, how does it fit into the longer term thesis you have of that enthusiasm maintaining itself?
Yeah, Zach. I mean, I think when you look at whether it be this ETF approval, the adoption of Bitcoin as legal tender by a sovereign nation, these are all just fundamentally huge steps in the development of Bitcoin as an asset and crypto as an asset class. Just to push back on your volatility comment, I think. One thing I would probably criticize about that is that we've actually seen Bitcoin's volatility over the past 1, 2, 3, 5 years gradually dampen. I think 5 years ago, the annualized daily volatility was around 80%. And these days, it hovers between 40 and 50%, depending on the day. And, there are certain, heavily traded equity securities and traditional markets that probably mirror that kind of volatility. So, okay. I mean, when you look at, risk-adjusted returns, Bitcoin right now presents an unprecedented opportunity for, traditional financial markets. And I think that this ETF really opens the gates for a lot of capital to come in and gain exposure to that opportunity.
Let's talk about maybe some more volatility out there. If people are getting bored, you know, tongue in cheek a little bit here with the volatility in Bitcoin, but your note cited, you know, what we've seen this year, at least in Ether's price moves. And we've been talking a lot about Bitcoin's dominance, of course, the market cap percentage that it takes up in the total cryptocurrency space. We've seen that fluctuate and come down quite a bit. It's been building momentum as of late. But when you kind of look at maybe where Ether goes in all this, and you guys have a $10,000 price target, if I'm correct there on Ether, talk to me about what maybe what we're seeing right now in Bitcoin's dominance coming down could mean for a setup in Ether's rally to end the year as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, what we've seen in prior bull market cycles for Bitcoin is that Bitcoin generally leads the rally. Capital rotates, you know, investors take their gains and rotate into altcoins. The most predominant, heavily traded altcoin being Ethereum. So normally that garners most of the rotated capital. So generally, Ethereum follows Bitcoin's move. And quite frankly, we think that a lot of people are overlooking Ethereum into the end of the year just due to the fact that Bitcoin has garnered the lion's share of headlines. You know, it's not, you don't meet the average investor that is aware of recent software updates in the Ethereum network. Recently, they updated the network with what was called EIP 1559, in which transaction fees are actually burned, causing a disinflationary effect. And what we've seen with the recent NFT craze is that all of the non-fungible tokens that have been minted and traded on the Ethereum network have actually led to a rapid increase in the amount of Ethereum supply burned. So we're actually seeing both sides of the supply and demand equation mm-hmm. have these accretive effects on price, where there's a lot of demand for ETH, and simultaneously the supply is growing at a much slower rate. We think that once some more capital rotates into ETH, we're going to see some bullish price action for Ethereum going into the end of the year.
I think that that's probably an important point to highlight here as we wrap up, just because, you know, we've talked about maybe if NFTs are a bubble, even if you think that they're a bubble, it does play into the idea that you're talking about there in terms of ETH being burned as you kind of move down those changes there to the network itself. I mean, is that maybe one of the take-home points you'd have for investors who might not be into the idea of NFTs staying as hot as they are right now?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're unsure about NFTs as a asset class, I mean, first, you know, I would probably advise you to just research NFTs a little more. You know, we're covering them more at Fundstrat and FS Insight, so you can follow us there. But you know, it's a pretty broad terminology that covers any non-fungible asset that is secured by a blockchain. And I think there's a lot of potential for NFTs as an asset class moving forward. But that said, if you want exposure to NFTs as an asset class without you know, having a granular understanding of which, you know, JPEGs you should be putting into your portfolio, you can achieve exposure to the NFTs through purchases of Ethereum. So that's certainly something to keep in mind.
Let's head over to Yahoo Finance senior columnist Rick Newman over at the Milken Conference. He's joined by PIMCO's head of public policy, Libby Cantrell. Rick, sounds like you're having a good time out there.
Of course, Brian. I mean, I'd rather be golfing with you, but here we are in Los Angeles having a good time. I'm talking with Libby Cantrell. She's head of public policy for PIMCO. Libby, thanks for joining us. Obviously, a lot of ongoing drama in Washington, D.C. The Democratic plans seem to be diminishing before our eyes. So are the Democrats going to be able to pass these two bills, the infrastructure bill that has some bipartisan support, and then the Biden bill that is the more the social welfare and green energy? Or is there some chance that this could all go poof?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, very relevant, especially given all the drama, as you mentioned. You know, our view is that failure is just not an option for Democrats here, that they have to pass something. And as you said, these are linked bills, this bipartisan infrastructure bill, which has already passed the Senate, just waiting for a vote in the House, and then the Biden agenda, the Build Back Better bill. However, failure is not an option, but it's going to be a lot smaller than what a lot of Democrats had originally wanted. And honestly, this has been pretty evident from the very beginning, because if you have very small majorities in Congress, the smallest since Grover Cleveland, actually, of any first-term Democratic administration, it was always inevitable that it was going to be much harder to pass something as big and bold as a $6 trillion deal. So we do think something gets done, probably by the end of the year. But again, it will be more watered down. And I don't think that should be news to anybody, just given the very narrow majorities in Congress that Democrats have.
You put a note out recently talking about two trends. One is the declining approval ratings for President Biden. I think most people know about that. Another important one people may know less about is that the public support for these big government programs seems to have dropped by a lot just during the last 6 months or so. What is going on there and why?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. Yeah, so on the first one, the sort of this fading honeymoon effect, this is, you know, very consistent with other first-term administrations. There's this, you know, usually very heightened approval ratings in the first few months of the administration, and then reality sets in. The governing is hard, and especially with these very narrow majorities in Congress. So in some ways, not, you know, and not surprising, as you mentioned, in terms of a declining Biden approval rating, although probably puts more urgency on passing his agenda. On the other poll that you're referring to, which is a Gallup poll that was just released, it does show that Americans have sort of declining support for more government intervention. And also, as you noted, this is actually a reversal from last year, where a majority of Americans were actually supportive of more government. Now, a minority of Americans are supportive of more government. And that is a headwind, certainly, to this Biden agenda.
This directly undercuts support for things like extending the child tax credit, more social welfare spending, and it actually makes it much harder to get it done when it turns out, oh, maybe the public isn't so excited about these ideas anyway. Isn't that right?
Well, actually, if you look at the polling on those particular provisions that you just mentioned, the polling is actually quite good. And so this is sort of a messaging problem for Democrats. They're letting this narrative of big, intrusive government, I think, take over when they really should be emphasizing things like the child tax credit, things like child care and universal pre-K, because on their own, those actually poll very well, have a vast majority of American support. So in some ways, this is just, messaging, which is very key in Washington. But you're right, I think this is an obstacle for those moderate Democrats who are already on the fence for a big package. Certainly, they can point to this recent Gallup poll as evidence that they should be going smaller.
So for the things that your clients and our audience care most about, not so much in the infrastructure plan, which seems to be more in the bag, but as part of the Biden agenda, do you think that certain large programs are just going to fall out completely in order for Democrats to pass something, or do you think it's going to be this other idea where the whole grab bag stays in, but instead of 10 years, maybe it's 4 years and so on?
Yeah, I think that's a big question mark. Honestly, Speaker Pelosi has indicated that she would rather go kind of big and bolder in a couple of areas and let some of these other things fall out. It's not clear that the president believes that. So I do think this is going to be sort of subject to more negotiations.
Do you see certain things, parts of the plan that are most endangered?
I think some of the healthcare provisions, the Medicare provisions, for instance, the dental and vision, which are very important to many members of Congress who would enjoy that benefit because of their elder age, is maybe more vulnerable. But I think that from a markets perspective, what our clients really care about are the tax provisions. And if the price tag is coming down, that likely means that there are going to probably be fewer tax increases. And I think that's good news from a market perspective.
Another topic here is the Biden administration's approach and policy toward China. They have not revealed a lot of this yet, but they have said basically sticking with the Trump tariffs for now, and we're going to start to engage with China. This is complicated. We don't have a lot of time here. But can you see this, any tangible China policies developing?
Yeah, so it's been interesting. I think something that's really important for folks to remember is that the Democrats were sort of the original China hawks. When China was allowed into the WTO, there were many Democrats on Capitol Hill who were pretty skeptical about that. So this idea that there was going to be some big reversal and a softening towards China under the Biden administration, I think really didn't take that history into account, didn't sort of appreciate that this had been sort of a longstanding view among Democrats, particularly around alleged human rights abuses in terms of China. So I'm not sure that we should be surprised by the fact that this has been an extension of the Trump administration's approach. The tactics are different, though. So I think that the strategic objective is pretty similar to President Trump. I try to isolate China kind of economically and politically. But the tactics are going to be different. It's going to be a lot more predictable, and it's going to be a lot more multilateral. So we've seen previews of that. USTR Representative Catherine Tai recently gave a speech sort of indicating that this harder approach will continue, but it will be more multilateral, less bilateral.
Everybody's a China hawk now, I guess.
politically popular. Yeah. And if you look at all of the polling, the vast majority of Americans disapprove of the Chinese Communist Party in particular.
Libby Cantrell with PIMCO, thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thanks.
Brian, back to you.
All right, Rick Newman, thanks so much. See you on the golf links very soon, my friend.
Well, the lucky folks in Austin, Texas, get to hear the roar of Formula One race cars this week. And to help us understand how Formula One is growing and could grow beyond just Texas, let's bring in Laurent Rossi. He is Alpine CEO, the sports car manufacturer, along with our auto. I was going to call you an auto nerd, Pras, because I know you love cars. Pras Subramanian, who is also our executive producer and car reporter here at Yahoo Finance. Mr. Rossi, good to have you here. How important is this, you know, this Formula One race in Austin, especially as F1 looks to go beyond the cities where it already is racing in the United States?
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me. It's quite important because it's building up on the momentum that Formula One has gathered in the past 2 years, mostly thanks to better coverage, especially on streaming, but also with Liberty Media doing a pretty good job at like advertising the sport. And I guess it's only fair that we have another Grand Prix in the U.S. In addition to the one already existing. So Austin this year, Miami next year. I think it's good for the sport. It's going to build on the, like I said, on the good base that has been building up in the past few years.
Hey, Laurent, Pras here. You know, Adam and I will probably go to that Miami race next year, hopefully. But a question about the kind of the future of the sport. A lot of rules changes happening in the next year or two. Do you ever see a future where we shift from hybridization to full electrification in F1?
Oh, that's a tough question, to be honest. At the moment, it is not possible really to imagine a full electric car having the same performance that the F1s are the current F1s are providing. So it would change the show quite a bit, not just in terms of raw performance, like lap time, if you will, but also even the noise. So it's a bit of a difficult one to answer. That said, it's a preoccupation of everyone to go greener. And it's only normal that given the future of the automotive industry is mostly electric, the Formula One is converging towards more electric. So whether it's going to be more hybrids with sustainable fuels, other solutions such as hydrogen, we don't know. But it's still under kind of like reflection, if you will. We're all thinking about it, all the constituents, the teams, the power unit manufacturers, the OEMs as well, the automotive manufacturers. We're all thinking about it together with the FIA and Formula One Management Organization and trying to see what's the right path for the sports to be sustainable and meaningful and relevant.
So this is Alpine's first year in Formula One, obviously part of the Renault team and now Alpine. You guys also sell road cars in Europe and in possibly expanding that, I imagine. What's it like having that F1 team there to market the business? Has that been a big boost for you guys?
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually the idea behind the whole move. The Renault brand was present in Formula One and the Renault Group was present in Formula One for 45 years. The return on investment was not really high enough, because basically we hit a bit of a plateau in terms of like that type of metrics. We would have to win to justify the heavy investment in Formula One. At the same time, it's part of the legacy of the group. On the other hand, the Alpine brand is a very niche brand, but born from motorsports back in the 60s up until the 90s. It was discontinued, but when we relaunched a new car, a smaller car, a sporty coupe, if you will, and we needed a bit of a exposure, and we figured that we could hit two birds with one stone and basically leverage the media platform that the Formula One is providing, and a growing one that is, to basically expand the visibility and footprint of Alpine. And it works, because since the beginning of the year, all our metrics are basically 100% high up. We're basically selling twice more cars only because we're exposed in 150-170 countries every other week through Formula One, amongst other things.
And in the past, over the last couple of days, I know you discussed this path of how you plan to reach the summit of Formula One by 2024. So in just 3 years from now, lay out to us what that roadmap looks like and how you're planning to achieve that, because it doesn't give you much time.
No, that's right. It's not a lot of time. In fact, it's simply based on the fact that the current era that's going to, I mean, the next era that's going to happen in 2022 will last 3, potentially 4 years. So the idea is to grow throughout those 4 years and make sure that we get to a point at the end of this new era. What I mean by new era is new technical regulations that will change dramatically the way the car looks, the way the car is designed. We all start from a blank page, all of the 10 teams, and we're going to be entering also a financial, new set of financial regulations that are going to cap in costs. So the idea is leveraging this blank page we're starting from, and the cost cap that's going to level off the playing field, if you will. We feel like it's going to be down to efficiency, the way you do things, savviness, experience, and that we have. So it's not going to be a fight with sheer dollars. It's going to be a fight with expertise, and we can potentially make our way back up to the top of the podium. And we want to simply like make progress every single race. So I'm more often talking about the 100 race plan, because we have more or less 4 seasons, including this one ahead of us, 25 races a season, more or less, who's counting. And that's 100 races for us to keep on making progress race after race until we get back to a place that's more in line with our ambitions. That is to say, contending for podiums and potentially contending for the title, even though you don't decide that. It's racing.
Hey, Laurent, speaking of racing, you guys had a big win this year. But I want to talk to you about the Netflix effect, the Drive to Survive show, how big an effect that's had on the sport. It seems to have grown in popularity, especially a lot here in the U.S. because of Netflix showing that TV show behind-the-scenes stuff. How big is that for you? And do you think, are you guys going to have kind of a piece in it next year with Esteban's win?
Yeah, well, I'll comment on the two things. Well, first, the Netflix effect is big, no doubt. It's helping us quite a bit because, in fact, it's showing the other side of Formula One, the one that people actually didn't really know about, because I have to admit it, Formula One had this quite antiquated image of like a sports for like petrol heads with a macho twist on it, which was really not something you would want to have. But it got modern. It got like a bit different. The current management, the FIA, are doing a tremendous job at making sure that it becomes relevant. It is tackling the real issues while being still an entertainment. And Netflix showed that. It showed the other side of the sport. It didn't show really like the technical part of it or the racing part of it. You hardly see anything about like the results of the races or the technology that those incredible cars are embarking. It's showing like the life of those people making Formula One, the drivers, but just not, the lives of the teams in the middle. And that brought a whole lot of different audience, if you will, which is helping us, because suddenly it's a sport like any other where people can come in and share a moment, just like the American sports. And that's what we like as well, because combined with the cost cap I was mentioning earlier on and the revenue, we're moving towards like pretty much like an American sports with a franchise type of model and an entertainment that goes beyond just the race itself. It goes way beyond that. It's bringing to people something different, something right. they can connect with. And that's quite important. Esteban's victory, it's another story. It's basically one of the first steps in the progress we wanted to make race year after year. We basically made quick steps already, but we stay very level-headed. It's only one step, and we have plenty of others before we get there consistently.